Hey, everybody. It is Monday, March 18th. We begin another week here on the Mo News Podcast. I'm Mo Shwanunu.
And I'm Jill Wagner. This is the place where we bring you just the facts.
And we read all the news and read between the lines so you don't have to. Just before we began the pod here, Jill, you were trying to sing a popular song to me. And I was like, you know, I used to feel like I was plugged in to like the latest trends in music. And you said, basically, I am going to effectively be not in the cultural zeitgeist for a few years right now as a new father.
Yes, these are your dark years. You're singing baby songs. You're reading baby books. You're not going to buy a piece of clothing for yourself for at least a couple of years. Just, it's all about baby-o. And just accept it. It's okay.
So I just want people to be hyper aware of that. Please DM me if there's like songs going viral, etc. I pride myself on staying on top of things, but it's going to be a dark period for a few years here until Olivia's old enough to tell me what's cool again.
Exactly. And it happens before you know it, because my daughter's 5 and doesn't let me sing, doesn't let me dance if she's around, and controls the radio.
Relevant to that, Jill, we put out some numbers just before the weekend on Gen Z. So this Gen Z is 1997 to 2010. Of course, the newest generation, the youngest generation, is Alpha Generation. But some stark numbers there as far as their views on society, their pessimism versus previous generations. We're talking about Gen Z here because, of course, Alpha is too young to really pull. But Gen Z versus other generations, some stark numbers. Jill, when asked things like, is it hard to have hope for the world? They wonder if there's a purpose to life given the world. The worst numbers that we've seen ever, and this goes through millennials, goes through Gen Xers, goes back to baby boomers. A lot of pessimism there.
Yeah, and you have to wonder, are things so bad? Or is it just that social media is amplifying the bad stuff? Is it a combination of both? But it seems like there is no way that social media is not playing some type of role here.
When you look at the charts, it basically, all these numbers on negativity and pessimism skyrocket starting in 2009, 2010, which was everyone has Facebook, the beginning of Instagram, beginning of TikTok, and it just continues to go up. So when every bad thing happening in the world is in your pocket and you have access to it 24/7, it probably reinforces it. At the same time, they'll argue between pandemic, between how expensive things have gotten, you know, the stark reminders of climate change, etc. Things are very negative. But then the counter, of course, Jill, from previous generations is, well, you didn't have the Great Depression and World War II, Cold War, the, you know, being at the precipice of nuclear catastrophe on any given day. You know, every generation has its argument for the things that could have made it just as pessimistic.
And to that end, Luke Russert, the late Tim Russert's son, weighed in on the Mo News Instagram account.
He's a friend of the pod. Some of you may have listened to the podcast we did with him last year.
So he wrote, yeah, okay. Millennials lived through Columbine, 9/11, saw our friends die in two questionable wars, braved a worldwide economic recession and a pandemic, and still found time to vote and care. Get off your phone and contribute.
Luke, fighting words. I posted that on Instagram. Like, if anyone would care to debate Luke on this from Gen Z, go ahead. And the point he's having is part of these numbers coming out on Gen Z are related to the fact that they're pessimistic and they wonder what's the point of even voting anymore if things are so bad. His argument is every generation has had rough things it's had to live through and yet still felt it had a civic duty to fulfill there. So Gen Z, you know, you're entitled to complain, as we all are, but don't stop voting and question the entire system that we have here.
Okay, with that, let's get to some news. The biggest change to the U.S. real estate market in a century, what a settlement on Friday means for brokers' fees and the cost of housing in America. Speaking of voting, we check in on a couple of third-party candidates and parties that could have an impact this fall. RFK Jr., close to naming a running mate, and the No Labels movement appears closer to naming their ticket. A judge rules that the Georgia district attorney can continue to lead the Trump prosecution, but only after the lead attorney she hired and had a romantic relationship with resigns. We take a look at the state of Trump's criminal cases and whether any at this point will happen before the election. Surprise, surprise, Vladimir Putin wins a historic fifth term as Russia's president, set to surpass Joseph Stalin in terms of length of rule in the coming years.
Jill, he went further than I even predicted, giving himself 88% of the vote over the weekend.
Someone's feeling confident.
Or not.
Yeah, or extremely insecure. Over in the Middle East, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu slamming Senator Chuck Schumer's speech last week as totally inappropriate, and also refusing to commit to elections in Israel, quote, until we win the war. China signals its opposition to selling TikTok in the United States. And the 2024 Olympics will be broadcast live at AMC theaters.
Yeah, bring your flags and get ready to cheer alongside fellow Americans. We'll see if this plan works out this summer.
And sticking with sports, March Madness 2024, the brackets have been set for the NCAA tournament. And Moshe has on this day in history.
A little Destiny's Child, a little Grover Cleveland, and the Sweet Life with Zach and Cody. On this day in history, Jill.
All right, we're going to start with a huge change for real estate costs and transactions in America. The cost of selling a home could soon go down after the National Association of Realtors agreed to a historic settlement on Friday. The powerful trade group, which represents more than 1.5 million real estate agents, reached a nationwide deal after lawsuits from groups of home sellers who accused the trade group of conspiring to keep broker fees artificially high. The group agreed to these massive changes in the way homes are bought and sold, all designed to let homeowners take control. So in addition to paying over $400 million in damages, the Realtors group agreed to stop requiring that home sellers pay both their broker and a buyer's broker. The landmark settlement would eliminate real estate brokers' longstanding commissions, commonly up to 6% of the purchase price. For decades, the NAR has required home sale listing brokers to provide an offer of compensation to a buyer's agent, and that usually comes out to about 6% split between a seller's broker and a buyer's agent. But that model has come under intensifying scrutiny from critics who have likened it to a cartel. Housing experts say that the longtime industry standard of a 6% commission on a sale is now estimated to fall to between 3 and 4%. And that could mean real savings for both buyers and sellers. An example, at today's 6% commission, a homeowner selling a $400,000 property will spend about $24,000 on broker fees, a cost that is passed on to the buyer. And depending on how much the new rules reduce commissions, that same homeowner could see their broker's fee fall to about $12,000.
Yeah, so this deal brings an end to a number of antitrust lawsuits that have come up against the National Association of Realtors. Last year, a jury found two brokerages and the NAR liable for $1.8 billion in damages for conspiring to keep commissions high. The accusation, again, was that the previous arrangement incentivized brokers to find the most expensive property for their client. So it's still too soon to tell here exactly what this means for the bottom line, but this is the biggest shakeup in a century here, according to the folks that have been watching this, offering more transparency, more competition. And there's a lot of alternative business models here being floated that will, you know, see potential experimentation or innovation in the market here, including a flat fee and discount brokerages that could become more widespread. Realtors will be allowed to advertise their fees, compete on commissions. Buyers will be able to shop around, choose lower cost agents potentially. And while some of this stuff has always been negotiable, there have been these standard rates. This really loosens things up here. And the question, of course, will this lower home prices in a market where interest rates remain high? The 30-year mortgage remains at a two-decade high still, and there is a lack of inventory, especially in certain markets here in the U.S. So experts say supply and demand will continue to be the biggest factor on price here, but there is a widespread hope that the reduction in commissions here, which are baked into sales prices, as you said, Jill, may cause home prices to fall just a bit, unless the homeowners here just cook that in and take home that money in the future. That said, you know, as we mentioned, innovation here, rules getting loosened. Some have compared this to the travel market, as you saw the demise of travel agents and the rise of booking sites like Expedia and Kayak. Will there be innovation here in the real estate sector? There are already sites like Zillow, like Redfin, that have made it easier to find homes. But of course, brokers still play a key role here. And that's the argument they make here, Jill, including those who follow the Mo News account, saying that buyers benefit from representation. Even if they decide, oh, this is willing to go it alone. And when buyers choose not to use representation, they actually harm themselves, that ultimately they do better with a broker. That's what the brokers argue here. But they'll have to figure out their business model here going forward as things change here. And as far as timing, and that's been asked by a few folks on Instagram over the weekend, a federal judge is expected to approve the settlement in the coming weeks, but there could be a continued litigation here that could postpone this For now, though, they expect to see this come into place in mid-July. As far as whether this means you should hold off on selling your property, people appear to be split on that, saying, you know, ultimately here, even if it's not the letter of the law or the letter of the rule, by July, you already could see some brokers being more amenable to what the new rules will be in the coming weeks and months.
All right, switching gears here, let's talk some politics. The RFK Jr. independent presidential campaign indicated over the weekend that it could name his vice presidential running mate as soon as this week. The person that he appears to be very seriously considering is Nicole Shanahan, a Bay Area lawyer and an investor who was once married to the Google co-founder Sergey Brin. Shanahan's name is being circulated amid a flurry of interest in his vice presidential shortlist, which previously included the NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers and former Governor Jesse Ventura of Minnesota. RFK Jr. was apparently into Rodgers, but some people around him have voiced concerns. Shanahan is 38 years old. She was the creative force and primary financial backer behind a $5 million Super Bowl ad bought and created by a super PAC that's backing Kennedy. The domain name KennedyShanahan.com was registered on March 13th, according to records. And some people around his campaign say that an announcement could come as soon as this week. Shanahan has a record of donating to Democrats, including to President Biden's campaign back in 2020, and she has described herself as, quote, a progressive through and through.
Yeah, so this is not final, but this was certainly very seriously pushed out over the weekend. First saw it over in Puck News, and then the name continued to circulate there, especially as he got some backlash for the potential Aaron Rodgers choice. So Shanahan here supported him when he was a Democratic presidential candidate. RFK, of course, decided to then run as an independent in the fall. She backed away from him, but then saw people, according to a New York Times interview, who were really revved up about him, seeing what she calls pockets of silent support around the country. So she donated several million to him. A little background on her. You might have heard of her before. Of course, married to Sergey Brin, involved in some entrepreneurial activities. But also amid her divorce from Sergey Brin, she was alleged to have had an affair with Elon Musk. Both she and Musk have denied it, but that's where her name first circulated in the headlines in the last couple of years. She says that her motivation to support RFK here has to do with her concern about the environment, vaccines, and children's health, and her belief that Kennedy is willing to challenge the scientific establishment. Now, apparently, one of the motivating factors of him choosing a running mate here is that as he seeks to get on the ballot as an independent candidate, many states apparently have rules that say that he has to get on the ballot with his vice presidential choice in one fell swoop. So his campaign's still working on getting him on the ballot in most states. His campaign says that he has qualified for the ballot in 4 out of 50 states right now, Utah, New Hampshire, Nevada, and Hawaii. He is trying to get on all 50 states. It takes a lot of work, nearly a million signatures, different rules in every state. His campaign actually estimates it's going to cost him $15 million to get on the ballot in all the states. They all have various filing deadlines. You know, it's one of the things that the Democrats and the Republicans have effectively figured out is a ways to make it very difficult for third-party candidates on the state level to get on the ballot. So that's one of the reasons Kennedy was flirting with the Libertarian Party, which has existed for a while and is already on the ballot in nearly 40 states. It does not appear they are very into him, so he's continuing this independent bid. We'll look out for this VP choice. And of course, can he get on the ballot in all these key states? Right now, polling shows that he's getting anywhere from 8 to 12% in various states and taking slightly more voters away from Biden than Trump.
And it comes as the No Labels moderate centrist party is taking another step forward at forming a bipartisan presidential ticket for November's general election. No Labels has announced the formation of a committee to vet candidates for the potential bipartisan ticket, and they could announce who will be running as soon as Thursday. Former Senator Joe Lieberman, who is the 2000 Democratic vice presidential nominee before becoming an independent a couple of years later, he is going to be part of a panel called the Country Over Party Committee. There have been a lot of calls from Democrats that have been warning that a No Labels ticket would basically pave a path to victory for Trump in November by siphoning moderates from Biden. Lieberman says that is not the goal. We are not about electing either President Trump or President Biden. In fact, they have said that if they feel that whoever their candidate is going to help elect Trump again and take that many votes away from Biden, that they would actually consider pulling that person from the election completely.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's still early when it comes to polling, but what you do see is that there's about a third of the country to 35% that are hardcore Trump, no matter what. And you do see softer support on the left for Biden. And with potentially an RFK Jr. here, a no labels ticket, Cornel West and Jill Stein on sort of the farther progressive left running independent bids, there is a lot of concern among Democrats that he's going to lose some people on the far left, but also some centrists who are not into him. And there'll be less of a siphoning of support from Trump here, who has a much more motivated base of voters. So that's why you typically hear more concern from Democrats here. And you've seen that some of the biggest funders, Jill, of the No Labels movement happen to be Republicans who also support Trump.
The plot thickens.
Listen, you could also go back to 2020. Remember who was involved in trying to get Kanye West to run for president? Jared Kushner and Trump campaign officials. Again, trying to effectively find ways to siphon support from the Democrats. Now, this is not to say Democrats don't play the same game here or will try to play the same game. It's just harder for them given, again, how motivated and how loyal Trump voters are to him.
All right, plenty of news coming up, but we want to first thank a couple of our sponsors this week, starting with Factor Meal. We are definitely pressed for time, especially in my house, and still want to eat healthy and nutritious meals. So that's why we are so excited about Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service. They can help you fuel up fast for breakfast, lunch, and dinner with chef-prepared and dietitian-approved ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. And you get to skip that extra trip to the grocery store, the shopping, the prepping, and my least favorite part, the cleaning up, while still getting the flavor and nutritional quality that you need. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are ready in just 2 minutes. So all you've got to do is heat and enjoy. You could choose from over 35 weekly meals. It is flexible for your schedule. You can get as many or as few as you need by choosing between 6 and 18 meals per week. You could also pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. They also have my favorite, cold-pressed juices, shakes, and smoothies ready in just 2 minutes. No prep, no mess. Head to factormeals.com/monews5050 and use that code monews50 to get 50% off. Again, that is code monews50 at factormeals.com to get 50% off. Great deal, Moshe.
And we want to thank another great partner for us here at Mo News, Athletic Greens. We're always talking about health trends, nutritional trends, how hard it is to get all of your vitamins. Well, one way we have found to get all the important ones here is Athletic Greens AG1 powder. I first tried it almost 2 years ago now as I was trying various vitamins after meeting with a nutritionist. And what I love about AG1, it's just one scoop with a glass of water in the morning. It's easy, it's quick. It lets you get on with your day knowing you've gotten more than 75 important ingredients, tons of vitamins and minerals, pre and probiotics for your gut and for digestion. It's effectively a nutritional insurance policy as you begin your day. And they have a great deal right now for the Mo News community. With your first purchase of AG1, Athletic Greens is giving Mo News listeners a free 1 year supply of vitamin D, 5 free travel packs of AG1 for you to take on the go. It is really easy. Just head over to drinkag1.com/monews. That is drinkag1.com/monews. That's where you can just try just once or get a discounted monthly subscription. Again, drinkag1.com/monews for this special deal and to start to take ownership of your health.
Time for the speed read from the New York Times. Nathan Wade resigned from his post as special prosecutor in the Georgia election interference criminal investigation into Donald Trump. An Atlanta judge gave his boss and former romantic partner, Fani Willis, an ultimatum, saying that her office could only keep the case if Wade stepped down. He did so just a few hours later on Friday. In a letter to Willis, Wade said that he was resigning, quote, in the interest of democracy and to move this case forward as quickly as possible. In a letter accepting the resignation, Willis cited his bravery for weathering threats as well as what she called unjustified attacks on his reputation. The ruling by Judge Scott McAfee on accusations of a conflict of interest cut a middle path between removing Willis and her full vindication. The judge sharply criticized her for dating Wade, whom she had hired to manage the election interference case, calling it a tremendous lapse in judgment. The Trump team was asking for the case to be totally killed over the conflict of interest allegations.
So middle ground here. The case against Trump continues, but a lot of damage here to Fani Willis, who loses her close confidant in Wade, well, more than close confidant, a former romantic partner. But as far as the trial is concerned here, someone who spent 2.5 years on this case. So she now needs to find a new special prosecutor here. Also, she has definitely been bruised by these embarrassing headlines and hearings of the past couple of weeks. So that could taint the views of a future jury, make convictions more difficult here. At the same time, Trump and his 14 co-defendants will still have to face Willis here when this case eventually proceeds. Willis is not completely free of issues, though. She could also face repercussions from the state here for her behavior, not only hiring Wade in an inappropriate way, dating him, also benefiting from him financially. If you go through the ruling on Friday, the judge really lets her have it for ethical lapses here. This case was first filed by one of the co-defendants of Trump saying, this feels inappropriate. You should kill the entire case. Of course, the judge, again, has found a middle ground here. But one positive thing for the defendants, especially former President Trump, is the delays this has caused. So this could mean, in all likelihood, that this case does not move forward until after the election. And Trump also has the option here of appealing the ruling, saying, you know, ultimately, we believe that she should still be kicked off the case. So that could delay the proceedings further and mean that this goes deep into 2025, potentially. We went into a bit of this over the weekend on our premium Instagram account, but you know, ultimately one of Trump's legal strategies here, as he's dealt with the four criminal indictments from last year, was how does he delay things as long as possible through a legal strategy here. So through legal strategy, through luck, and in the case of, in a couple cases here, especially in Georgia, prosecutorial incompetence, the only criminal trial that Trump may face before this November's election is the case in New York, the indictment related to Stormy Daniels, hush money payments, improper bookkeeping, and taxes. And that case, by the way, was delayed an extra month on Friday, Jill. That was supposed to start this month. It is now delayed until April, because in that case, the prosecution did not make thousands of documents available to Trump and his defense team. So the judge has now kicked that back. So in all likelihood, it looks like that happens in 2024. But this Georgia case and also the two federal cases, the election interference case, the January 6th case, which has now a Supreme Court ruling related to it this summer, as well as the classified records case out of Florida, those in all likelihood don't begin after jury selection, et cetera, until after the election as well.
And that Stormy Daniels case with Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA, that's the one that a lot of legal experts even say is kind of the most iffy. It's pretty much unprecedented. It's a bit unprecedented. And in terms of just public opinion polls, that is the case when those charges were filed. That is when Trump really solidified his support. So it was that case that really galvanized some of his voters behind him.
Yeah. And that's the case that also it came first. And so that led a lot of his voters to say all these cases are BS. But, you know, what's notable about the case you mentioned, the Stormy Daniels case, you know, with Alvin Bragg prosecuting it, is he's very political, an elected Democrat. And so even some Democrats said at the time and still to this day, you know, this seems like kind of a iffy case and, you know, transparently looks a bit political versus these other cases related to January 6th, election interference, classified records being in his home.
From Reuters, President Vladimir Putin has extended his rule over Russia for a fifth term in office, a foregone conclusion after a presidential election this weekend that the Kremlin had stripped of any real competition. He was first elected in 1999, and his next term lasts until the year 2030. Preliminary results released by Russia's Elections Commission, which is overseen by Putin, showed that he got about 88% of the vote.
Jill, that's what they say.
Putin is a former KGB lieutenant colonel. He first rose to power in 1999. So this result here is intended to underscore to the West that its leaders will have to reckon with an emboldened Russia, whether in war or in peace, for many more years to come. He now cements his grip on power, even though thousands of opponents staged a noon protest at polling stations on Sunday. That is something that Putin critic Alexei Navalny called for before his mysterious death in a Russian prison last month. The United States, for its part, has said that the vote was neither free nor fair.
So with this new term, Jill, should he last till 2030, he will overtake Joseph Stalin as Russia's longest serving leader in more than 200 years. He recently changed the laws there to make himself eligible for this fifth term and then a sixth term that he could run for in 2030. If elected again then and lasting until 2036, he would then surpass, for those who are familiar with Russian history, Catherine the Great, the empress from the 1700s, as the longest ruler of Russia ever. Right now, Putin is 71. He'd be 77 at the end of this next term, 83 by the end. So, you know, everyone now, Jill, is electing their septuagenarians and octogenarians, though in this case, in Russia, you don't really have a choice because anyone who was remotely anti him or anti war was not allowed on the ballot this time. And he continues to change the constitution in Russia to continue to maintain and tighten his grip over the judicial system, over the media there. And you've seen that more and more over the last decade, which led some of you to ask us over the weekend, why even have these elections if he runs Russia with such a tight grip and these elections don't matter? And so he's had some loyalists who are like, just kill the election thing at this point, man. Like, you know, just be leader for life. But people around Putin and the Kremlin regard the process as conferring an element of legitimacy on him in relation to foreign leaders. And so he thinks, and this is why you see this with a lot of dictatorships around the world, that they have these quote-unquote elections to present themselves at home and abroad as, listen, you know, I am having elections and look how popular I am. Jill, it sort of reminds me of, with this number, this is the most significant number he's gotten in his entire rule. Now he's getting close to what Saddam Hussein did in Iraq or Assad in Syria, like where they're giving themselves 90-something percent of the vote. All that said, one of the things we're going to closely be watching here is what does he do next? Some have said that he was waiting to do some unpopular things until after the election here, in particular calling up more Russians to fight in the war in Ukraine. Now in its third year, the war has taken a major toll, though Russia is not being very transparent with how many deaths they've seen, but the estimate is 100,000 plus even more injured. The war has stagnated. So remember that very unpopular draft he did in 2022 that led many to leave the country. The sense is that he's going to have to do another one this year if he's looking to maintain the war effort.
From ABC News, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday denied claims that he is an obstacle to peace in Gaza and said that Senator Chuck Schumer's controversial call for Israelis to hold elections to vote him out of power was, quote, totally inappropriate. Netanyahu said it's inappropriate to go to a sister democracy and try to replace the elected leadership. That is something the Israeli public does on its own. We are not a banana republic. Israeli elections are not scheduled again until 2026, although they can be held early if there is a vote of no confidence or if enough coalition partners leave the government. But many Israelis, including some Netanyahu critics, believe that Schumer's speech was an attack on their sovereignty. Netanyahu also said that polls show that a vast majority of Israelis support the war, and even the plan to invade the crowded city of Rafah to destroy the last remaining Hamas battalions. Netanyahu added that the only government Israel and the United States should be working to bring down is, quote, Hamas tyranny that murdered over 1,000 Israelis and dozens of Americans during the October 7th attack.
Yeah, a lot of Israelis, even those who are critical of Netanyahu, saying, you know, that this was an attack on Israeli sovereignty from an ally. But it did come, Jill, as you saw over the weekend, ever larger protests in Tel Aviv against Netanyahu calling for immediate elections, that it still only represents about a quarter to a third of the Israeli population if you look at polling. But that's something we'll be watching here. Former President Trump over the weekend chiming in on the conflict, which he's done pretty rarely here. He did say that he supports Israel's war in Gaza, but it must finish it up and do it quickly, in his words. He also went after Schumer and Biden for telling an ally how to run its government, and made his case to American Jewish voters that Democrats are, quote, bad for Israel. But Schumer did get a lot of backing in his own party over the weekend. As Democrats, if you look at polling, increasingly within the Democratic Party, there's an ever larger divide over views on the Middle East. Former Speaker Pelosi saying over the weekend that Schumer should be listened to because of the reputational risk here for Israel. Jill, we have a deeper look at all of this over on the Premium Pod. We'll be out later today, an interview with Barak Ravid, a reporter for Axios, analyst at CNN, who has some really strong sources within the Israeli government, American foreign policy establishment, breaking down what's happening there. To be able to listen to that, join Mo News Premium over at mo.news/premium. And we have a deal that runs out at some point today for a free 30-day trial. Use the code MOWEEKEND.
Yeah, we often source Barak Ravid in our reporting because he has so many scoops in terms of the Middle East and what's going on in Israel. Okay, from the Wall Street Journal, the Chinese government is signaling that it won't allow a forced sale of TikTok, limiting options for the app's owners as buyers start to line up to bid for its U.S. operations. Chinese officials have criticized the U.S. for its moves targeting the short video sharing app. They have also sent signals to TikTok's owner, ByteDance, which is based in Beijing, that company executives have interpreted as meaning that the government would rather the app be banned in the United States than be sold. In Washington, the House voted overwhelmingly to approve a bill on Wednesday that requires ByteDance sell off TikTok or face a ban, contending that the collection of American user data by its owners poses a national security risk. It still has to be passed by the U.S. Senate and signed into law by President Biden. TikTok has said that it will not share the data with the Chinese government, even if Beijing demands it. U.S. national security officials, as well as a couple of former ByteDance employees, say otherwise. Beijing's message to ByteDance is that it would face regulatory hurdles if it sought to divest TikTok. China has warned that a sale or a divestiture of TikTok would involve exporting technology that would have to be approved by the government. Hence, Moshe, I guess this all kind of proves the point of lawmakers who are concerned that China has too much power over TikTok.
Yeah, it really reinforces the idea that the Chinese government is in control here, despite what TikTok says about what they will or will not hand over to their owner, ByteDance, and what ByteDance says about the Chinese government. At the same time, lawmakers here also note that guess what's banned in China? Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. They don't allow powerful, influential social media apps owned by non-Chinese entities, in particular, an adversary in the U.S., to operate there. So why should the U.S. allow the same thing here from a Chinese-owned app? It's the same thing you've seen essentially with the Chinese company Huawei. It's a tech company that, given its relationship with the Chinese government, the U.S. has put a lot of limitations on. And as you described here, ultimately, there's no real private sector in China. They all report into the government and they all have to do what the government says in order to operate there. Notably, TikTok itself is not even available in China. ByteDance owns a separate app called Douyin that uses a similar algorithm in China and is subject to Communist Party censorship there. So remember here, the legislation basically lays out two options if and when President Biden signs this into law. TikTok, your owner either has to sell you to a non-Chinese entity and you can continue to operate here in the U.S., or you will be banned here. And essentially what you have here is a game of chicken. The Chinese government saying, we're not going to let ByteDance sell off, even though TikTok is worth upwards of $100 billion and there's probably going to be a bidding war for it, even more so. So will the Chinese government give up $100 billion plus for ByteDance here just on principle, or will they allow a sale here? And that's going to be something that'll be really interesting to watch here, given everything that's unfolded. And as we've mentioned on previous pods here, the U.S. government essentially did this a few years ago, requiring the Chinese government to sell off Grindr, the gay dating app. Now, it was much smaller, much less controversial at the time, and the Chinese essentially did it. That's why it continues to operate here. TikTok is on a whole nother level here, and one of the questions everyone has is, even if they sell off TikTok, if they allow ByteDance to sell off TikTok, will they allow the algorithm to go, the algorithm being something homegrown in China that is particularly sticky, right? That TikTok algorithm is so addictive. People spend more time on TikTok than any other social media app when you look at the numbers. And so some people have floated, would China sell TikTok but without the algorithm? Well, how much is TikTok really worth then? So there's going to be a lot of questions here as this legislation moves through the Senate and to President Biden.
Moshe, we started this podcast talking about Gen Z being the most pessimistic about America compared to previous generations. Well, some would argue TikTok's algorithm is partly to blame by amplifying those anti-American messages. So some of those concerns that lawmakers have and experts have already coming into fruition.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, we don't know causation here. There's definitely a correlation. But ultimately, that's the fear here, is that China very easily through ByteDance can mess with the algorithm to try to create chaos, create hatred about democracy, create a division within America. Even if there's no evidence that that has been done yet, no direct evidence, that is the fear, and certainly anecdotally here, a concern that it might already be happening.
All right, from NBC Sports, AMC will show live daytime coverage of the Paris Olympics at 160 theaters in the United States. The games will take place from July 27th to August 11th. The coverage will be presented as live ticketed events and will begin the day after the opening ceremony.
So go buy your popcorn. Get yourself an extra large soda and watch some swimming, watch some gymnastics with your fellow Americans in theaters across the country. It's an interesting concept, Jill, especially coming off of the success AMC had with the Beyonce concerts, the Taylor concerts, alternative ways to get you inside the theater.
The question is this something Americans want? We'll see.
Listen, depending on how hot it is where you live between July 27th and August 11th, if you're looking for some air conditioning and a fun collective way to watch the games, that's one of the things, too, with modern media, that we have lost these collective moments, right, that we used to have in the network television days where, like, we all watched a show live on a Wednesday night or must-see TV Thursday. So creating these elements, this could be cool. We'll see how it works out.
And from ESPN, the field is set for NCAA March Madness. On the men's side, UConn, Houston, Purdue, and North Carolina all secured number one seeds. Defending national champ, UConn was selected as the number one overall seed and will begin to defend their title on Friday. The last team to win 2 years in a row was Florida in 2006 and 2007. The SEC saw eight teams selected for the tournament for a second straight year, including Tennessee, Kentucky, Auburn, and Alabama. The tournament is scheduled to start Tuesday with the first four play-in rounds. The number one seeds and the rest of the tournament field will play their first round games on Thursday and Friday.
Jill, no dice for our GW and Michigan men's basketball teams this year.
I'm very aware of that motion. Or Ohio State for my husband.
Right. Your house has teams that typically make it to the tournament much more often than my alma mater does, but I still tune in for the Atlantic tournament every year to see if GW will surprise me. As far as the Final Four and National Championship, that'll take place in Phoenix from April 6th to the 8th. Though, Jill, Thursday and Friday are typically some of the most unproductive days of the year in most offices as people start to tune into the games around noon on Thursday. Over on the women's side, they also had their selection Sunday yesterday, and their tournament will begin. The Iowa Hawkeyes' Caitlin Clark is poised for another Final Four run after a season, as we've told you about, where she broke the all-time female scoring record and all-time male scoring record in the tournament. So a lot of eyes will be on her as she goes professional next year. We'll also be watching LSU and Angel Reese to see if they can get a repeat this year. And among some of the other women's teams we're watching, UConn, Stanford, Texas, and the University of South Carolina, all vying for a national title. The women's games will start on Wednesday. The women's Final Four takes place in Cleveland this year from April 5th to the 7th.
Moshe, you and I have been tinkering with the idea of doing some type of Mo News bracket, whether it's best presidents, worst presidents, something historical, and then we can ask people to vote on what they think, and that would be the bracket moving forward. So we're still pondering.
We're going to put up something on the Instagram account today asking for ideas as to fun brackets, news adjacent, politics adjacent brackets we can do here. Of course, there won't actually be games or competitions. We'll be making our own judgments as to who wins, or maybe we'll have you vote on winners for each of the games. But if you have any ideas, send us a message on Instagram. All right, Jill, this brings us to On This Day in History. But before we get there, on Fridays, instead of On This Day, we do what we're eating, watching, and reading. And we just wanted to follow up because you were trying out a new recipe for what we're eating this past weekend.
That's right. So I was trying out avocado bread, not to be confused with avocado toast, which is avocado on toast. Avocado bread is avocado, cheese, and an egg mashed together, put onto parchment paper, and then you put it in the oven for about 30 minutes. And it's basically like a low-carb bread. Good. Meh. I think it needs something.
We give it a meh.
Yeah, like it was, I was actually disappointed. I thought it was going to taste a little bit better. In fairness, I think I went too light on the cheese. I probably could have gone.
Use your error.
Yes. I think if I had used more cheese, it may have been better.
Jill, general rule of thumb, more cheese is always better.
Yeah, exactly. Here I'm like trying to make it a little bit healthier. I don't know what I was thinking.
No. Always more cheese. Okay, let's begin here back in On This Day in History. 1837, Grover Cleveland was born on this day. I only bring him up because he's the only U.S. president to serve two discontinuous terms as president. He is both our 23rd and 25th president. He was our president in 1885, loses re-election, then comes back in 1893 for a second term. And so I only bring him up because Trump is trying to repeat this feat as a president, losing, and then running again. So Grover Cleveland, born on this day. we move to the 20th century here. Mohandas Gandhi was sentenced to 6 years in prison on this day for civil disobedience, protesting the British colonial government in India. Now, Gandhi ended up serving 2 of the 6 years. He was released for medical reasons. He had an appendicitis and continued his nonviolent resistance against the British, trying to free India from British rule. Finally, in 1947, India would gain its independence after being a British colony for more than 200 years. A little more than a year later, though, Gandhi was assassinated. On this day in 1969, B-52 bombers from the U.S. were diverted from South Vietnam to attack suspected communist base camps and areas in Cambodia for the first time in the Vietnam War. Now, this was a secret operation that Nixon and Kissinger tried to keep secret from the public, from frankly everybody. It was meant to shut down reinforcements for the Viet Cong coming out of Cambodia. Though Cambodia was officially neutral in the war, the secret would last for a couple months until the New York Times got leaks about it and would reveal it just 2 months later in May of 69. Though the bombing in Cambodia would go on for 14 months, the U.S. is estimated to have killed 150,000 civilians during that bombing campaign. It would lead to chaos that would lead to civil war there for decades. An estimated 2 million people would end up being killed in Cambodia under the subsequent regime that took over in the aftermath of that bombing. And we end this on this day on some lighter pop culture items, as we typically do. On this day, 46 years ago, the Bee Gees released Night Fever. It stays on the top of the charts for 8 weeks, becoming the longest running hit of 1978. All right, from a big 70s hit to an 80s hit that many of us know and love. 39 years ago today, Tears for Fears released their song, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, released on this day in 1985.
Which, given the news of late, I feel like could be the anthem of 2024.
In fact, Jill, the band has said that. They wrote it about the Cold War in the 80s and were asked about it a couple years ago. And they're like, yeah.
It still holds.
They said, yeah, no, everybody wants to rule the world. And the song about war still holds, sadly.
They were ahead of their time.
Speaking of another group ahead of their time, Destiny's Child, 24 years ago today, out with their song, Say My Name, Say My Name.
A former producer of mine, who shall remain nameless, strongly believes that Kelly Rowland should have been the breakout star from Destiny's Child, not Beyoncé, and she feels very strongly about it.
Controversial opinion, given that Beyoncé has won the most Grammys of all time, Jill.
I didn't say it was my opinion, Moshe.
And finally, we'll drop an item here for Gen Z. On this day, 19 years ago, The Suite Life of Zack and Cody premiered on the Disney Channel.
You're welcome, Gen Z. Don't say we didn't do anything for you.
Jill and I were too old in 2005 to be watching The Sweet Life with Zack and Cody.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Mo News Podcast, where we officially have something for everyone. If you like what you hear, please share this with your friends. It'll help us grow. Follow us and subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and review us in the App Store.
And thanks to all of you who joined Mo News Premium over the weekend. Several hundred of you are giving our free trial a try. I hope you enjoyed the weekend coverage and the Q&As, as well as the premium pods. Again, we have one on Israel out today. We have one on Haiti that was out late last week. As far as the premium podcast is concerned, the premium feed on Instagram was rolling along all weekend. You have a chance at that 30-day free trial right now with the code MOWEEKEND over in mo.news/premium. Give it a try. See how you like it. And let us know.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
Later.
Thanks for listening to the Mo News Podcast.